that gavel.
Jump in and walk all over.
So, ready now?
Yep, you can call a meeting to order.
All right, I'd like to call the meeting to order.
I really have.
And having done so, we'll turn it over to the town attorney.
Sure.
It's actually gonna go to Wes.
Yeah, not.
I'm gonna turn it over in head to Wes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for opening the meeting and inviting me here. Happy New Year. My name is Wes McLeod. I'm with the Cape Fear Council of Governments. I'm the Local Government Services Director. And so tonight, we're going to go through an overview of statutory quasi-judicial procedures. Lots of fun. Lots of fun. So, is that me?
How many people are on the call?
Just two.
Two?
Craig Goddard being one.
Good.
And it's my understanding that you all serve. So we've got PNZ members in here, council members, and the PNZ also serves as the HPC, correct? Okay. And so as far as the HPC meeting for certificates of appropriateness or any official business, has that transpired to date?
No.
Okay. All right. Got it. And we can possibly move the computer closer to me if that would help. So Craig would be able
to.
Okay. All right. So we're going to go over this is going to be a pretty much an overview. And I would prefer, this doesn't need to be any type of formal presentation. So if you see something up there that strikes you as odd or requires some additional clarification, just jump in and ask. And Jim also is going to jump in and provide some additional clarity as we go. If I've gone through something too quickly. But we're going to go through legal context, types of decisions, the quasi-judicial procedures, basically as they are out of the statute. They're all very specific. And then some items related to standing, evidence, and conflict of interest. Now, a lot of this stuff, comes up also commonly for Board of Adjustment. So, it's also good material from that sense as well. Okay, so local governments are creatures of the state, and they have no inherent powers. In home rule states across the U.S., we have what are called home rule states and Dillon's rule states. And so in home rule states, basically, you can do anything you want so long as it doesn't violate the state or federal constitution. In Dillon's rule states, you have much, much less power. Only those essentially delegated to you by their legislature. So North Carolina is not a home rule state, but we do have fairly broad powers. Pardon? Not yet. Yeah, powers that are expressly granted by the North Carolina General Assembly, and. The reason, when it comes up specifically, and sort of what one of the things that we're going to talk about, quasi-judicial procedures, right? You guys can't have your own quasi-judicial procedures as a local government. Those are established by the state legislature. They've told you how you need to handle those items. You can't say, hey, well, we want to do our certificate of appropriateness like this, or we want to do special permits like this. There's certain guidelines within which you can act. Another example, local government several years ago said, hey, we want to regulate the design of one and two family dwellings. The legislature said, no, I don't think so. I don't think that you should have those powers, local government. And so we're going to say specifically that you can't do that. And there's a host of other things that have come up recently.
Did that come through a challenge, or had the legislature heard about this and stepped in? Did somebody challenge that?
Tea Party momentum several years ago.
Yeah, there wasn't necessarily a challenge to someone's local authority, but the legislature stepped in and the Home Builders Association put forth a bill. It was about snout house. Houses that have garages on the front of them. The Home Builders Association did not want local government to say you can't have those, because that was what was happening in a couple of neighborhoods, or proceeding to happen in some neighborhoods outside of Charlotte.
The General Assembly, in one degree or another, North Carolina courts have really been interestingly fairly strong towards preserving and giving adherence to property rights.
Correct. And so, you know, you guys have heard some of the recent, you know, efforts under play by the General Assembly. There was a bill that was put forth to preempt local government regulation of trees, for example. Said we don't, you know, so this is an example of, if you're a home rule state, which we're not a strict home rule state, we could say, well, I don't, doesn't matter. We're going to regulate trees however we want to do it, and we're allowed to do it. But in North Carolina, we can't. So it's important to understand that when you're crafting rules and regulations, and understanding it as a framework within which you have to operate. So there's four types of land use decisions. The first, is legislative. So those are your policy decisions. Those are decisions that the council hears. Specifically, when you're adopting a budget, when you're doing a text amendment for your ordinances, or rezoning, which you all don't have very many rezonings, but you hear about them all the time. Those are legislative decisions. You guys can determine at the whims kind of what decision you want to make based on public input. Folks show up and they don't like something, you can say, I'm going to listen to what, you know, the community says, and we're going to align our decision with them. You have pretty broad authority to make whatever decision you feel is best. Those decisions are not necessarily appealable to a board of adjustment. Advisory decisions are not final decisions. They're less regulated. These are the decisions that oftentimes a planning board is providing. The Planning and Zoning Commission is saying, hey, we recommend approval of this text amendment. There's no finality to it. It's just a recommendation. That is a common function of the Planning and Zoning Board. Third is administrative. These are routine tasks, typically that staff administers. Oh boy. So, you know, if John's issuing a zoning permit or a building permit, that's an administrative decision. If someone is displeased with his issuance of that permit, they can appeal that to the Board of Adjustment. Similarly, we have communities that the governing board will approve subdivision plats. That's an administrative decision, even though the council's approving it. And the fourth is the most complex of them and confusing, is quasi-judicial. These are your formal actions where decision makers apply discretion. So essentially these are court-like decisions, and there's very strict rules and regulations and procedures for how these decisions are made. These are your special use permits, your certificates of appropriateness, variances, and appeals. And so the majority of these are heard by boards of adjustments. It really depends on the particular community. Some communities, a planning board or the governing board does special use permits. Some, the board of adjustment does it. But in all communities, so far as I know, for certificates of appropriateness, those are issued by the Historic Preservation Commission specifically. Okay, so getting on to quasi-judicial procedure specifically, and this most of this material is just right out of the statute. Board shall follow quasi-judicial procedures in determining all these things that I just mentioned: appeals, special use permits, COA, certificates of appropriateness, variances, or any other quasi-judicial decision. Those really are the only items that folks really are doing in a quasi-judicial fashion. We have some communities that have some funky ordinances that require, if someone's going to make a change to something, that it be a quasi-judicial decision. I disagree with those ordinances. That's, in my opinion, a variance. It should be rendered as so. But this is right from the statute. I will say that there are some communities also in the capital area and other parts of North Carolina that they have subdivision decisions that are quasi-judicial and fairly complex. We don't have much of that here in southeastern North Carolina.
And the difference being, we're administrative, meaning that if somebody brings in a plat and it meets the checklist set forth in the code, you have to. The subdivision statutes, which are determined by quasi-judicial decision-making, allow for discretion of the deciding body to impose certain conditions.
That's correct. And so, you know, there was a recent court case in Columbus County, for example, where the Board of Commissioners there, they denied an administrative subdivision plat approval. And they are now found themselves in court, and that decision is going to be immediately overturned because the subdivision that was provided met the standards of the ordinance. They denied it anyways because neighbors and residents were mad, but those neighbors and residents, by the rule of law for administrative decisions, don't have any say in that. So long as the standards are met, that needs to be approved.
And since we're on the topic, administrative decisions, 95% of them go to BOA, but when it comes to subdivision decisions, they go directly to court.
That's correct. Okay. So your quorum can be based on your local ordinance. I'm not sure what it is for your HPC. It's probably simple majority, I would imagine. Voting for your COA, it's simple majority. For a variance, it's you need 4/5 to approve a variance. And then the hearing, it's not a public hearing or a legislative hearing. It's actually an evidentiary hearing that you're gathering facts, not public opinion. And this can be problematic in a lot of communities, but you do need a detailed record of that hearing. You need a verbatim transcript, a detailed minutes, basically. And, you know, for you guys at the HPC, I don't anticipate that you're going to have incredibly controversial hearings, but you could. I've seen some, you know, quasi-judicial hearings where they've got a court reporter present because they know that that's likely going to go be the next thing that's going to happen is that thing, whatever decision is going to get appealed at the next level. Yes.
Two questions before you leave this. Mm-hmm. It's been my experience that determining a supermajority given the qualifier of vacant seats and disqualified members is tricky for the lay persons composing those boards. Vacant seats in this case does not mean somebody that is absent. It means a vacancy that needs to be filled. Disqualified members are members who have a conflict of interest on that particular topic. The question I have for you, based on your experience about the court reporters, I've always been in situations where the applicant is responsible for that, but I'm aware of other jurisdictions, and I think this is one of them, that they supply that in order to be on, you know, to be thorough and comprehensive. What's been your experience?
that the local government provides it because they don't want to put the burden on staff, and you know, they really need to have a transcript, and so especially in instances where you've got multiple parties, you've got multiple folks that are going to provide testimony, and if you think the meeting's going to be a 6-hour ordeal, it's a heavy lift for, you know, a clerk that's used to doing pretty standard meeting minutes.
What about COAs? Have you seen?
I've not seen really controversial items for COAs.
Our preservation district's got a simple test. It's got to be consistent.
Right.
The look and feel of the district. So I don't think we need court reporters for a situation like that.
I don't think so unless there's something crazy that comes up, unforeseen. But yeah, it would usually be, you know, for some type of appeal or something, some other matter that would be not with HBC but with a BOA. Okay. Evidence must be presented under oath and cross-examination must be allowed. The chair may subpoena witnesses, although I've never seen that occur. And the chair or clerk to the board may administer the oaths. And so depending on how you handle it, in a lot of our local governments, at the start of the meeting, they'll say, hey, anybody that's intending to speak whatsoever, come on up. Whether or not, even if you're not necessarily sure, come on up and get sworn in so that that's taken care of. Because what happens is, in the midst of the meeting, someone will decide, oh, I really have something to say, and they'll have to be sworn in again, or someone will forget to swear them in. There are written findings of fact that are required, and so where there's, you know, conflicting evidence or facts, you guys need to, the board must specify what it determines to be the facts that are the basis for the decision. So if there's two folks giving you alternative sets of evidence or their opinions, you guys got to figure out what's what and make it clear as when you're making your decision. And so depending on the community, those findings of facts are fleshed out at the close of that hearing and summarized by the board, or staff helps summarize them at the end of the meeting based on what transpires. And I'm not sure what your typical procedure has been here.
Can I comment on
that?
Yeah. I find that this is the most difficult part for a quasi-judicial decision-making board comprised of lay personnel. I find that this is the most difficult thing that they deal with, because several things have to happen. You have to have the findings of fact. You also have to identify the evidence that supports that finding of fact, and you got to sum it all up. So a couple of points. One, every quasi-judicial decision gets reduced to writing. The attorney does that. So it's not like you've got to be hyper-technical at this stage of your decision-making, because the attorney's going to take care of everything thereafter. But you still, by statute, are required to make the findings and to identify the evidence. The council is aware of special use permits. You have, I think it's four different elements that they have to prove in order to get that permit. Same thing with a variance. Unique conditions causing a unique hardship that are not the result of the applicant's own actions. Well, each one of those is a finding of fact, and there may be additional findings of fact to get up to that. Remember, legal people don't go 2 and 2 is 4. They go 1 and 1 is 2, add an additional 1, that's 3, add an additional 1, that's 4. So you got to build up to it. So in a variance, you know you're going to have 4 findings of fact, because those are the 4 things that have to be proven. But there may be additional findings to get there. For example, we you have a special use permit, somebody's brought in an expert opinion on the diminution of their property values if the permit is granted, that particular section, you would say, you would identify the expert, you would summarize his qualifications, you would find that he is an expert, and depending on what his opinion is, you would either find it or find against it. When it comes to COAs, the findings would be very simple because all you're trying to find ultimately is consistency with the neighborhood. But you may have additional findings. In fact, let's say somebody comes in and wants to paint their house white. The ultimate finding of fact would be applicant wants to paint his house white, which is a color scheme consistent with the neighborhood. But you might want to build up to that historic, you know, finding of fact. Most of the residential houses in the D1 district have white siding, and then work up from that till you get to your Thompson. Thank you.
That's a great summary.
One quick question, if I may. On the hearing, it says that the hearing of each case must be open and closed. Now, when we sit up there,
do you mind?
Go for it.
It depends on the experience of the deciding making board, and it depends on the applicants. Typically what happens, and it's not a quasi-judicial hearing, is not a public hearing. You're not doing anything for the public, you're not providing notice to the public, you're not giving them material that they can come in. They can't even comment on these things. The only people that can comment, or I'm sorry, the only people that can give evidence is the applicant and people who have standing that are opposed to what the applicant wants. Point one. Point two, when you come into, and I don't think I've done it for you all yet, but I think I probably should, I certainly will for HPC, and I believe I've done it for BOA, which actually handles quasi-judicial very well, as a matter of fact, and returning personnel. But you'll get a cookbook. One of the agenda items will be special use permit application. And the agenda materials will be whatever staff puts together, a summary, the provisions of the code. But included in there will be, and I forget what I call it, order part of it, but it'll be a mini agenda for that agenda item. And it'll be the chair opens that hearing. You're not opening the meeting, you've already done that. You're opening that hearing. The next item is swearing in the witnesses. The next item is staff's presentation, which is under oath and is part of the evidence, and whatever summary they put together is an exhibit to the record. Then you hear from the applicant, then you hear from, if any, opponents that are opposed to it. Typically what happens, like a public hearing, is the applicant's going to say everything, the difference being that he's under oath and whatever he or she puts into the record is an exhibit. At that point, several things can happen, but I work with small towns and I rarely see it happen. Sometimes I wish I was on the board so I could make it happen. But anybody on the board can ask questions, and anybody that has standing can cross-examine that witness, whatever side of the fence they're on. And there'll be times when I attend those hearings and I appear in those hearings, and I do so in an advisory function. Unlike a typical meeting, I can't tell you black or white, A, B, or C, or D, but I can suggest to you how you proceed. So you'll have some guidance, and if anything looks like it's falling by the wayside, you'll get a heads up in a proper way.
That really led me to where I was kind of thinking of going, because we're supposed to only consider the evidence presented
That's correct.
And I have the ability, if I have an awareness to something, that I can challenge a piece from the bench.
I don't know that you want to challenge it because you're the
decision. But I can ask a question.
Yeah, you can see. Yeah, you can think of countless examples. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
For example, if you're having a variance and somebody's trying to make the case that there's a unique hardship, but it comes out he or she's not very articulate, sure, you're going to want to ask a question. Well, Ms. Jones, what is the particular hardship? Whatever.
Okay.
To get at the findings of that.
And I think that's a great question, but I'd be curious to have Jim weigh on this. But there's a fine line, and you know, you guys aren't supposed to be trying to advocate or you're not supposed to be questioning necessarily evidence. You know, you guys are listening and trying to figure out, you know, which side the decision should go, if that makes sense.
If the fatal flaw that'll get you in court with a sophisticated developer and probably cost you attorney fees as well is to be anything less than absolutely impartial and making sure that nothing that comes out of your mouth suggests otherwise, particularly if you've got a court reporter in the building. But, that's why ex parte, you know, typically rezoning, you all might discuss it individually amongst yourselves before the meeting comes up. That's a no-no for quasi-judicial. Going and doing your own homework is also, most of the time, a no-no for quasi-judicial, because you have to come in without an opinion, because that's due process to give the opportunity to be heard and to accept what evidence is being tendered and to render a decision on it. That's due process, and you'll get in trouble if you don't.
And you're making public comments about this.
Absolutely.
And that can get you disqualified.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
And you make a decision based on what's presented. I mean, there's no extension to this thing.
That's correct. Unless the hearing is continued.
You didn't bring that up. We haven't heard it. This is our decision.
That's correct.
And yep. No closed sessions.
Yep.
In most cases, and I've only, as a staff person, been sitting in all these two big things that are going on in my career. But if it's something that's really controversial or wanted very bad, then they're going to hire the right legal representation to walk them through and make sure nothing gets left out, that every expert explains their credentials, yep, and that no rock is unturned, and so to give the council every bit of the information they need to make a informed decision.
Correct.
And you're going to get into expert opinions.
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't agree on that.
No, that's a good, great question. All right, so we covered witnesses, conflict of interest. The Constitution gives parties to quasi-judicial decisions a right to impartial decision maker, so conflict of interest must be avoided, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, but the reality is these boards should be held in some independent location somewhere. You shouldn't be sitting behind, you know, the town government seal, you know, particularly when it comes to appealing some type of staff decision. You're independent arbiters. You're hearing two parties, regardless of where you are.
We'll put a sheet over there.
Yeah. Open meetings, all meetings, and these are open meetings, it's the same as this meeting is an open meeting. And so this is, some folks will close the hearing portion of this, and some boards will close the hearing portion and then deliberate amongst themselves. But I don't necessarily recommend doing that. That's a personal opinion of, or a opinion of each local government. If you close the hearing, if you want to hear more testimony from somebody else, you got to open back up again. And just, I don't think that it makes much sense.
But the chair controls, mm-hmm, everything. You're like a judge.
Yep.
If you leave the meeting open, for the reasons that Wes suggested, and somebody jumps up and says, well, wait a minute, I want to add something else. You don't public hearing. It's a trial. You can cut that person off. You can cut off redundant testimony. If an HOA is coming in to bitch about everything, you can ask them to appoint, you can make them appoint one spokesperson for that. You control the show. So if somebody gets up and says, well, I want to say something else, you can say, sorry, we're not taking any more evidence, or if you need it, take the evidence.
This is key, and this is, you know, folks get caught up on this, but there's three criteria for evidence. Evidence must be substantial, competent, and material. It's got to be entered into the record and kept on file. So depending on if it's, you know, if it's a more formal board, if there's an attorney representing an applicant, they will ask for each thing to be entered into the record as exhibits, as Jim alluded to. And then this was just discussed, but well, hearsay and non-expert testimony cannot be the basis for a decision or for establishing a fact. So, you know, I can't say that there's going to be a bunch of traffic, and I'm not a professional traffic engineer. You can't base your decision on the fact that I said there's going to be a whole bunch of traffic on XYZ.
You're going to get into the statute?
Yes. And this is key. And it's really hard for board members not to do this, but board members should not be gathering evidence outside of the hearing. You know, all that evidence needs to be heard at the meeting. And, you know, the fact that you're, while you may be intending to be impartial, it's, as you are going down a path of looking something up, it inevitably leads you in the direction, in some particular direction. And the other party is not there to say, hey, what you're looking up is wrong, incorrect, whatever it may be. And so you got to try. You'll get a packet in advance. You can look at that to prepare yourself. But you should be prepared to really hear the evidence at the hearing. And then only evidence presented at the hearing and subject to cross-examination should be, again, considered. And Jim mentioned earlier ex parte communication, and really it's undisclosed ex parte communication is not allowed. That's where you guys are talking about a case amongst yourselves or with someone else, and you're not in the hearing portion of the meeting. And so if it occurs, if someone brings a case up to you, I always recommend, and Jim, as your counsel may ask, does anyone have a conflict of interest at the start of the meeting? Has anyone had any discussion regarding this? Say, hey, so-and-so came up to me when I was in a restaurant, and they started asking about this. I merely told them that there's a hearing on this date at which they should attend, and I am not allowed to disclose or discuss this case with you at that time. That is that will be heard on this date, and I think you should attend.
And let's talk about challenges that occur. Some member may get up and says, I think I should recuse myself because I have a conflict. Well, then the board votes to excuse him from that hearing. But likewise, either with that proffer that Wes just gave, or for whatever reason, the applicant or the applicant's attorney may challenge one of the members and say, look, you've got a conflict of interest. Bottom line is, if the member doesn't excuse himself, and it comes to pass that you have to determine whether there's a conflict of interest or not, it's done so by majority vote. And actually, Alan can be up there with the mayor, and Alan can say, Mayor, I think you've got a conflict. I don't think you should participate. The mayor says, no, I think I'm okay. I'm going to participate. Alan can call a vote on that, and a majority vote determines whether you stay or go. Okay.
And I don't know if I have a slide on this, but I'll say if someone is recused, you know, you you basically need to move yourself out of the hearing room. Go ahead and if you've got another hearing after that, you know, go somewhere else in the building, but you should not even be in the room.
Three lines. About someone approaching you at the restaurant, you said the meeting's going to be held on such and such a date.
Yeah.
I suggest you go to the meeting. But I thought they weren't public meetings, so anybody can go to them, or
it's an open meeting.
It's an open meeting, but it's not announced as a public meeting.
There will be mailers sent out to, you know, the applicant and adjacent property owners, and obviously, you know, it'll probably be on town.
Yeah, I'll put
town,
the town news.
Town
news,
people, yeah.
They can come, they just can't, unless they've got standing, they can't participate.
Yeah.
It's like a courtroom gallery.
That's right. And in some communities, the public, they let the public talk, but just because you talk doesn't mean we're going to take into account your testimony. Okay, so, and this is what Jim's alluding to in standing. These are the folks that can legally participate, cross-examine, etc. in these hearings. The owner of the property or someone with an option to purchase or lease the property and the applicant for a development approval. So obviously, if there's an approval that concerns my property, I'm going to have standing. So any other person, and this is the tricky one really for local governments, but any other person who will, quote, suffer special damages as a result of the decision being appealed. So this could include parking, stormwater runoff, crime problems, or some type of property value impacts. But just, you know, living nearby is not enough to prove. Now, you know, you're going to have your legal counsel there to help you with these decisions as they come up. And when someone says, for example, that their property values are going to be impacted as a result of this, they need to have some type of certified appraiser's report attesting to that. Similarly, with saying that they're going to have some traffic issue, there needs to be some type of transportation engineer's report attesting to that as well.
Wes, before you leave that, based on your experience, tell me what you think about this. Standing is a very difficult thing for even the courts to figure out. And I swear it took me years to understand what special damages are. If you get rear-ended, you got property damage, you got personal, you got medical expenses, you got pain and suffering. Special damages is that camp, if you let that campground occur, based on my expert appraiser, my property values are going to come down by 10%. That's a special damage. So it gets real difficult because if somebody gets up in the hearing, somebody stands up and says, look, I want to cross-examine, or I want to put on some evidence. Again, it's not a public hearing. It doesn't automatically happen. They've got to have standing. So you're going to get in, and an advisory attorney is going to help you through that process. Well, Mayor, you may want to ask these questions, and so we'll get you there. But I've been in jurisdictions where if it's a close call, but you and I might think they don't have standing, they let them participate because they figure it all come out under judicial review.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you have an opinion about that?
I think it's tough. I mean, the thing is, oftentimes they may not even...
They probably don't know enough to present.
That's right, and their testimony may not be fact-based anyways, in which case the whole thing is irrelevant. They're just a disturbance of the meeting.
And is that noted at that moment? Like, if this is not fact-based, like, is that when we say, thanks for sharing that,
sure,
but it's not fact-based?
So the question of standing depends on each local government. Some folks do not even broach the subject. It's just kind of a free-for-all, and hopefully they're going to sort out what the facts are based on the evidence that's substantial, competent, and material. other communities, the first item on the agenda, the board will say, these are the rules for standing. Is there anyone here in this room that feels that they qualify to have standing for this hearing? If so, please provide reasoning why. There's benefits to both, because if you go the latter with determining who all has standing in the room, it can be a complicated thing to sort through, as Jim alluded to. And you may end up wasting a bunch more time other than just letting folks say their piece, even though they're not really supposed to, and just not taking their testimony.
When they share that information at that moment, is that a time to say it or later?
I wouldn't say it, because at the end, you're going to weigh the evidence and you're going to determine what is competent, material, and substantial. And that's the proper time to do it, about shining a light on it.
Okay. I'm imagining two different board members having a different opinion about whether this is fact-based or not.
That's right. So just think about it in general terms. I mean, you need to be an expert on whatever it is someone is attesting to. Someone can't just come up here and start saying that the noise is going to be X, Y, Z, and there needs to be reports for things. If it's talking about property values, you need to have an appraisal. Traffic is a common one. You need to have a transportation engineer. If there's stormwater runoff issues, there needs to be a civil engineer present. In that way, it can be pretty clear cut, but it really depends on every case.
Wes made a very good point. The applicant's going to take care of his or her case. The opponents have to have special damages. Whatever that special damage is, probably ultimately needs an expert. So if you're having this hearing and somebody gets up and says these things, you don't have to say, well, I'm sorry, you don't have an expert, we're not going to take it. It's just that, and again, it's a balancing act, because you don't want them to go on and on and on and on. But if it's a close call, then go ahead and take the evidence, because you know at the end of the hearing, when you make your decision, you know that by law, you can't consider that. So it's just not even going to factor into the end analysis. But still, if it's a close call, whether that... And it depends. If it's a huge red button issue and you're getting a whole bunch of bad press, and somebody wants to say something and he or she doesn't have 20 other people lined up behind them, and they argue vociferously that they have standing, well, maybe we take 5 minutes and take that evidence, because we know, being educated in quasi-judicial proceedings, that at the end of the day, when we find what evidence supports the required findings of fact, that person didn't present competent material, substantial evidence, and therefore disregarded.
When you come to a decision, I guess you have to get to that anyway.
Sure.
Do we have to state why we went one way or the other?
Neither. You make findings of fact.
Yeah.
Look, when I have a trial, I have an opening statement, I put my witnesses on, the defense puts their case on, we go, this is crazy, that whoever wins, the judge is going to say, draft me a proposed judgment. So we go back, and the first part of the proposed is called findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment. The way I draft quasi-judicial decisions are, let's take a variance where you have those four elements. Each one would be a finding of fact, and under each one I would identify the evidence that supports that that was presented at the hearing, that's competent material and substantial, that supports that finding. And then from there I go to conclusions of law, and again the variance applicant has met the requirements for variance, and then there's the order where you issue the variance, which all you have to do is, and I do have a question for Wes about this, at the end of the hearing, depending on what you're dealing with, you're gonna make the findings of fact, and you're gonna identify the evidence, and then you're gonna reach a point where you decide, based on those facts, and based on that evidence, whether the applicant gets what they want or not. I've always found an awkward situation on the findings are usually done by consensus, and the decision is by a vote, mm-hmm. majority or supermajority. Mm-hmm. And that's the way does that square with what you do?
Yeah, typically, and again, it depends. Sounds like you guys do a really good job. We have other communities that do not a very good job of nailing down the findings of facts because it is so, it's complicated. So they will talk in general terms about what are the facts. They just may not be really well articulated, as you alluded to. But they'll talk about, you know, everyone will have said their piece, and you guys will be talking about, hey, you know, this structure was built on this date, and you know, because of this, whatever it may be, we talk about the white building. There's white structures all around the neighborhood. You know, those are really facts. You may just be talking about it in generalities.
And a couple of other things. I usually provide a worksheet that, for example, if you were doing variance, I would keep part. If the hearing's over, I distribute a worksheet. Findings of fact. Did the applicant did/did not establish a unique hardship? I'm just making this up. So applicant did. Below that, so you circle did. Below that, identify the evidence that supports that finding. And so a lot of times I will facilitate the conversation. I don't make any of those decisions. But I'll walk you through what needs to be done. That's my advisory function. What I do want to avoid is voting on every finding of fact. And that's a nice way to get there, but it creates all sorts of risk, because you might vote, you know, thumbs up, thumbs up, thumbs up, thumbs up, and or thumbs down. It just gets real awkward, because you're going to have to make a final vote regardless. So even though it can be a laborious process, the findings of fact and the identification of the evidence should be reached by consensus between the members. Again, with some facilitation, I think that would be helpful.
I need to interrupt just for a second. Chairman Galbraith is on the line. He has a comment question.
Sure.
Yeah, hopefully everybody can hear me.
We can.
Excellent. Okay. The question or comment I had comes back to the idea of what constitutes an expert. And this kind of comes from my own personal experience. I've been qualified as an expert by about 45 times in court. So I feel pretty comfortable that when we were talking about, let's say, the value, property values or traffic studies, I don't think we're limited to a licensed appraiser or something like that. When you look at the definition of what an expert is, and this is what I've heard in court, and you know, obviously Jim can correct me, but basically it's a person with scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge which can assist in the trier of fact, which in this case would be the board. And you know, that's a fairly broad definition that does allow, I believe, the board to really determine what the expert is. Just like a judge can. A judge can have a fair amount of leeway in terms of what defines an expert in his or her courtroom. And I believe that's also would be the case in this particular type of situation. You know, I just wouldn't want to be held down to a very narrow definition of an expert in what we're doing, where there may be other people that come in. And if we can show that they have scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge, that would be useful, that we could declare them as an expert also.
And we can talk, there's some evidence. Yeah, I mean, you guys, the bottom line is, you guys can do whatever you want. I mean, you know, you can pull a crazy guy off the street and say that he is the expert of all experts, and we're going to take all his testimony into account, and we're basing our decision 100% on what he has to say. The problem is, that decision is going to get appealed at the next level, and as a part of the review, the superior court judges say, I don't think so. And so, absolutely, you guys have broad authority to kind of do what you want, but you just got to remember that it may come back to bite you down the road.
And
well, there's also a standard of Daubert also. You know, where just having somebody come in off the street wouldn't pass a Daubert standard. You know, somebody does have, you know, come from a field, let's say, of psychology, and they published, and you think that's appropriate to this particular thing. So I believe as long as it is a reasonable definition that person has established scientific or knowledge that's appropriate, that person can be declared an expert and withstand any sort of appeal.
Sure, yes. I, and that was a hyperbolic example I gave. I just...
Okay.
No, I agree. You can just use the general standard established by the rules of civil procedure. I don't think you need an appraiser for property damage diminution per se, but it's something that would be familiar enough for courts and anybody reviewing it to follow more easily. But sure, you're not limited.
That is tough. That's tough. Because just because you have a degree in psychology doesn't mean you have a good psychologist. Right?
Sure.
Because you have a civil engineering degree, it doesn't mean that I don't know how to design a ramp.
Right.
Well, yeah. When you qualify an expert in a trial, Your Honor, I'd call Alan Oliver to the stand. Mr. Oliver, what's your occupation?
X.
How long have you practiced that profession? Are you licensed? Has your practice been continuous? Where did you get your license? How long ago did you get your license? Has there been any interruption in your license? What is the particular field you practice in? How long have you been in that field? And then you get to various standards and you determine whether those standards that he practices in are acceptable to his profession as a whole. And so you just wrap in, you got your curriculum vitae, you walk through his publications, his seminars, his training, his education, and at the end of it, you present him to his honor, you know, I tender Mr. Oliver as an expert in X. The same sort of thing. So if a psychologist, if an appraiser comes in who's totally familiar with commercial appraisals but hasn't done a residential appraisal in 25 years, that might be a situation where I let him have his piece. But when I'm making my decision, I would say I don't think he's an expert on residential. So, you know, we'll take his evidence as a lay opinion on that. There's just lots of ways to play.
Yeah, but on both sides are going to have their experts.
Well, that's exactly the next point, which is that sitting up there, we're not asking those questions.
No.
It is either the man trying to verify he's an expert or the challenger trying to prove that he's not an expert.
Yeah, but that's correct.
Dealing with lay applicants, and they may not know enough to do that. And so then I do think it falls on you somewhat to flesh it out, because otherwise you've got to think beyond the hearing to the courtroom. So if I'm you and I'm sitting up there and Joe comes up and provides the whole tricky thing is the applicant versus the attorney, which I'm sure you're going to get to, but I represent Joe. I get up and I say, well, look, I'm going to put the mayor on as an expert in this, and here's his qualifications. And I might just go 1, 2, 3. You know, I just totally lay an egg. I don't cover what I should cover. Well, I think at that point, some responsibility falls on the board, because otherwise, you've got a very gray area that is going to impact your decision making and could also impact judicial review. So if you're on your game, you might want to say, well, hang on, counselor, I have some questions for the mayor. And so then you would walk through whatever questions you need to satisfy yourself and your colleagues, whether we're dealing with an expert or not, because it can get messy if you don't, if it's not presented sufficiently, you may want to take a more leading role so that that mess doesn't bother you in the hearing or down the road.
Okay, so that's not an indication of impartiality, though.
No.
Okay, so you're just trying to help yourself make your decision. I got
correct.
It. Okay, good advice. Thanks, Jim.
Another determination of standing is an association, an HOA, that basically one of the individuals in that HOA would have standing otherwise, and an HOA wasn't formed specifically as a result of the hearing.
So I'm not familiar with that. So if one property owner would have special damages, then the HOA has standing?
That's correct.
That's interesting.
Yes, and likely not going to happen for the COAs, but that's where it's very common for then the HOA to hire their own legal counsel, because they've got the wherewithal to do so. And then the unit of local government that has made this, so if this is for a different matter, but if it were appeal, obviously the local government also has standing as well.
Your BOA can make a decision that you all can appeal, that the council can appeal. That's the interesting part.
Local government and any person who would have standing to appeal that decision shall have the right to participate as a party. This is, you know, right from the statute here. Okay, more on evidence. And this is right out of the statute. So we had a couple questions about this. Not be testimony of lay witnesses that the use of property in a particular way affects the value of other property. This is really where it's getting to. Hey, you probably need somebody that's got some certification just to be safe. But again, you can take into account whatever anyone says. It's just you're on the line for it. The increase, and this again, right from the statute, the increase in vehicular traffic resulting from a proposed development poses a danger to the public safety. And this is in the statute because these are the two most common ones that come up. And then third, matters about which only expert testimony would generally be admissible under the rules of evidence. And this is where you get into, you know, having your legal counsel present if you need to. Discuss some of these things.
Just a funny anecdote. One time I had a personal injury case and the plaintiff was a chiropractor, and I was able to convince the judge that to qualify the plaintiff as his own expert witness. So the chiropractor plaintiff who also was his own expert witness. That was fun.
And for these, you know, You're not in a trial court, the rules of evidence are not necessarily required here. Conflict of interest, we discussed this briefly prior. This is also in the statute, and it's been clarified a little more as a result of 160D. Cannot have a fixed opinion prior to that hearing. Cannot have undisclosed ex parte communication. We mentioned that. That's just any discussion regarding the case outside of the hearing. And then you also can't have a close family or other relationship with the affected person. The close familial relationship has now been specifically defined, which it was not prior, which is spouse, parent, child, etc., and in-law. And then the fourth is financial interest in the outcome. And so usually the question comes up most often is often related to the financial interest piece. You know, I've seen it commonly where someone may be a real estate agent that's part of a firm that's associated with a development, and you need to get kind of specific there. You know, they need to be a limited partner in whatever the project is, for example. That, you know, just because they're an agent in the firm that's representing this client or whatever, it's probably not enough for them to determine that they've got some type of financial interest. But that's again, you know, can be a question that you can get some advice from your legal counsel. I will say that if you think that any of these items are going to be present for you, I would send a question out before the hearing to your legal counsel also. Hey, XYZ, so they can be prepared to help sort out, you know, if there is actually a conflict.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
So, this probably refers more to just the preceding topic, but if you have someone that's not a party to the matter, doesn't have standing, comes in as a member of the public, but yet actually does have expert knowledge of the topic that they want to talk about, because they're the public, is that ignored?
That's a good question.
I don't think it comes up.
I would say, yeah.
Because
I could see a situation where somebody commiserates with the person that's bringing the action, a neighbor, that doesn't want that particular action to happen. And they come into it, but aren't actually a party to it and haven't been asked to be a witness.
You know, they would have needed to do some prior research, you know, to be able to provide some type of reasonable testimony to support the case one way or the other. I think it would just be, you know, they may provide some type of opinion on a matter. I guess that boils down to whether or not you want to take it into account, depending on what it was.
I also think there's a hyper-technical analysis that might fit, but it is hyper-technical. We know that the people that can participate in the hearing are the applicants and those who have standing. That expert doesn't have standing.
Yeah.
So how can he or she participate, unless they're being presented as an expert by someone, the applicant or someone who does have standing? Besides that, I think if you let that expert pop out an opinion, and he or she doesn't have standing or is an applicant, I can't tell you how, but it sure seems like it's opening a can of worms to me, legally speaking, which is legal fees and money.
I would tend to agree. Jim alluded to this earlier, but if an objection is raised and someone refuses to recuse themselves, the rest of the board will vote on that recusal. Parties and witnesses. So this is really a lot of what we've already been talking about, but parties with standing have rights to present evidence, cross-examine, inspect documents, and object to testimony and offer explanations or rebuttal. An attorney may represent a party and act on the party's behalf. And then based on an ethics opinion, and this comes up in a lot of our smaller local governments from the North Carolina State Bar, non-lawyers may not provide legal advocacy on behalf of a party. So this happens commonly for builders, for example. They'll represent an applicant basically in the same guise that an attorney would. And technically, based on this opinion, they really shouldn't be doing that.
And I want to talk about that for a little. A couple of things. One, John Batten and I had a CAMA variance hearing where I think DCM was really focused on this ethics opinion. And it got to the point where I was instructed that John could not say anything. It had to come from me. And I think that's a hyper-technical application of that rule. I mean, the way I heard it, I couldn't even call John as a witness. It all worked out in the end. But Wes, what I'm wondering is when I read that opinion, it was dealing with the presentation of a case.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, the builder representing the applicant can't call to support the applicant's case his own experts. You know, I'm a developer and I call Kathleen as an expert for my client Joe. But if you take it to its logical conclusion, an applicant can't do that either. I mean, if I'm the applicant and I've hired experts, does this ethics opinion mean that I can't call them?
No.
Because what do you think?
I think that because you're the applicant and you have standing, that you would be able to, but...
Don't you think I'm practicing law?
I agree.
I
agree.
And examine them?
I mean, it's... I think it is a squirrely subject, but I was... I mean, it says that parties withstanding have the rights.
That's true.
You know.
That's just, true. That's your answer.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah, because the developer wouldn't. Yeah, that's good.
But so I will say to this. This is very loosely regulated, and
but it is a criminal offense.
So we have lots of local governments that they do not follow this, and that's okay. That's up to them. So architects, engineers, other land use professionals can participate as witnesses and provide evidence, but they cannot. And so this goes back to the question I think that was raised earlier. They are not supposed to cross-examine, make legal arguments, or examine evidence. So, you know, likely that expert that shows up in the public, really what they're doing is cross-examining or questioning something that's been said, and they really shouldn't be doing that. All right, and we talked about this a bit. The findings of fact, conclusions of law, they need to be in writing. They must be signed by the chair or other authorized member. They must explain the logic behind the decision. There's always a question of who prepares them. Jim's already asked that. You know, for here, it's Jim will prepare those. When are they prepared? Typically within a few days of the hearing. And then when are they approved? Also, typically upon chair signature, so you know, doesn't necessarily need to be at does not need to be at the next hearing. You know, that you can sign them, you know, a couple days later, or whenever they're finished. Some testimony and evidence considerations, and we really talked a lot about this, but so you know, it's. Trying to figure out how that non-expert testimony is handled. How those folks in the public that they don't know that there's even supposed to be an expert or they're standing or there's any other stuff. How are you supposed to handle them being in the audience and allowing them to speak? And so you know that's got to be ruled on the chair. We've talked about this, but typically they can be heard but cannot be the basis of decision. And so you know.
That's the least controversial way to proceed.
Yes. Let them say their piece and move on. You know, again, if you've got something incredibly controversial, likely would not be at your HBC, but a BOA where you got all types of parties and everything, you may cut some of that out by going through a determination of standing. But typically, this is a way I see it handled. How should standing be determined? Again, we talked about this. It must be ruled on by the chair or board, not staff. So there's sometimes questions about who has standing before a hearing. This is typically for an appeal matter. And so someone may believe that they have the right to appeal some type of issuance of a permit, and staff can't say that they don't. You know, you got to go through the whole motion, schedule the hearing, show up to the hearing. The first item is, do you have standing? No. Or yes, whatever it may be. And time limits are generally not permitted. So, you know, you may, in most local governments, in their public hearings, they'll say it's three. You got 3 minutes to speak your piece. In these hearings, that's not the case. That was it. And so that's it. And I will say you can limit redundant testimony. And the last thing I'll say, and I should send it to Jim, but there was a recent New Hanover court case that really gets into some of the meat of some of the stuff that we've talked about. There was a special use, I believe it was a special use permit, that was denied based on kind of very loosey-goosey evidence. Folks that were not experts attesting to matters of traffic and other things. The Superior Court upheld that decision, and then it later went to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals judge went specifically and said, hey, these folks are not, you know, transportation engineers, they're not experts. This decision should have never been based on that testimony, and spelled it out pretty clear. And I'll see if I can get you a copy of that. And it goes into some of the stuff.
Right. Question for you, Wes. So the findings of fact are, we won't be, we will not be making a decision that not to wait till the findings of fact are approved and then the next meeting we did that?
No, you make a decision that night. And so you can continue the hearing, but the decision is final that night. It's just reduced to writing at a later date.
You're going
to
make your findings.
No, but if I'm going to make it seem fun. Like I remember doing it the other way, it's the most community. But I never was I'm just an audience member.
So years ago, some communities would continue it and have the final decision at the next hearing. That's, you guys make the decision, it gets reduced to writing, becomes official upon chair signature, which is usually 2 weeks later.
I remember a council making a decision where they stated basically their opinion and it got overturned. And in most cases, if there's something really going to be controversial or going to be really wanted a development, a large area, both sides are going to have attorneys and they're going to walk through every. They're not going to allow any stone to go in.
Yeah. That sometimes it's nice to have that because the attorneys will clear everything up.
Yeah.
That's correct. That's all I have for you guys. I really appreciate your time tonight. I don't know if you have any other questions at all. We're obviously available, but or any other thoughts about this?
One other thing. Is it February that we're going to do the mock thing? We're going to do a mock COA quasi-judicial hearing in February, and I'm going to throw so much at them that it's going to be very entertaining. So you might want to come. I'm going to take all these things and play.
What's so funny?
I don't know. Do you have a fixed opinion?
I don't know.
I don't sound very impartial.
I'm afraid.
I'm ready for it. Bring it on. It'll be fun.
It will be a lot of fun.
I mean, hopefully most of these will, half of this stuff will never even matter for these COAs, but at least you've got the background.
Well, we did do one.
Okay.
We did have one before Jim was on board.
Oh, okay.
That seemed to go okay, but it was a little harrowing.
We didn't have any opposition. We really didn't have any problem with it. We just had to go. There were no basic issues.
Okay.
Look, this is the legal stuff. Let me give you an anecdote about the real world. I had an applicant one time that wanted to do a daycare on Cafe Road, and you needed a special use permit. They went up twice and got shot down twice, and then they hired an attorney, me. So Pilots Ridge is a development over there, and they successfully defeated it both times by getting in there and complaining about traffic. because there was a school somewhere on that road, and they were concerned about multiple traffic. But they didn't do it through an expert. So, knowing all this stuff, I hired a traffic engineer. We did a traffic analysis. I went up in a helicopter, and I did videos and pictures of peak time, morning and afternoon. Hired an engineer as another expert. At the time, the county had time limits on presentations, and so I argued that that was against due process. And at one point, the opposition complained, "Chairman, this is so frustrating. Mr. Eldridge is trying to turn this into a trial instead of a public hearing." And that's exactly what I was trying to do. But with the timely, and they put on all this evidence, which was not competent because it was lay opinion. So my 5-minute rebuttal was spent laying out all these objections. So I did everything by the book, and I lost. I lost.
So that's the real world.
And it is frustrating for laypersons because they don't understand why their complaints can't be heard for these. Their complaints can be heard in other matters when they're legislative decisions, but not for these. And so, yeah. And it is, they will not be cut and dry. You guys will be in there saying, "We went through this training, this should be really, you know, easy." But every case is different, and I mean, we have local governments that we've literally done the training. They have a meeting the next week, and things are, no one knows which way is up. So it's just how it goes. So thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Very good. Always
good. Vice Chair, I need to make a motion to adjourn the meeting.
I make a motion that we close the training session. All in favor?
Second.
I need a second.
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?